Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 115 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog is here with us as always. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody. Thanks for listening.
Have you finally concluded your travels? Are you back in the Chicago office?
Well, actually, after having spent 5 days in Wichita, the aviation capital of the world, where I got to fly the mighty Cessna Skycatcher. But listen, I don't want to make all these airline guys feel bad, so we'll save that for later.
Okay, very good. Also with us this episode to give us a hand is Gavin Werbeloff. He was our guest from episode 109. Welcome back, Gavin.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon from the West Coast.
Fantastic.
What happened to Dan?
Dan should be joining us in a little bit. We're also expecting John Ostrower to drop in, the flight blogger himself. And David Vanderhoof, I think, is not going to be able to make it today because he's returning from his trip to the Oceania Air Show. And so we'll look to have him live next week. Our guest this episode is Chris Mano. Chris is an airline captain for a major U.S. airline. He also writes the Jethead blog and cartoons over at Flight Crew Zoo. Chris was also with us back in episode 91, but we're really glad to have you back with us today, Chris.
Glad to be back. Great fan of the show.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind.
No, he's not. I mean, he works for a major airline. They can be as kind as they want.
Does it matter?
No such thing as too much kindness when you're an airline guy.
It's good info, though. It's good crosstalk.
We like it.
I'd just like to just make a quick announcement concerning Harriet. And you may recall Harriet is our favorite 80-year young Airplane Geeks listener. Well, Harriet has just recently had some major surgery, but it looks like she's come out of it real well. And so we just want to wish Harriet a speedy recovery. I know your son is keeping you listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast, and so I'm sure you'll get our well wishes.
Hey, Harriet, you're not kidding. You've got to feel better. That shirt alone should do it, but hey, you know what?
That's right.
I would have thought that would have been enough, but maybe not.
Right. I think Harriet's got a lot of strength in her, and we're sure that she's going to recover quickly. Okay, so with that, let's get started with the news. First item comes from ABC News. This is United and Continental shareholders approve merger. Now, we were expecting this. This was obviously scheduled, and it was expected to get approval from the shareholders of United Airlines, actually their parent UAL Corp, as well as Continental Airlines. And in fact, both groups of shareholders have approved the merger. In fact, according to the article, more than 98% of the votes cast by Continental's shareholders approved the merger. So I don't think anybody was really expecting there to be any difficulty amongst the shareholders.
You know, there was a shareholder suit right when it was announced based on the share exchange that they were getting. I think the Continental shareholders get about 1.05 UAL shares for every Continental share, and they weren't happy at the price. But apparently that has run its course. I don't know the specifics, but you know, if 98% approved it, then
That's a pretty clear clear statement.
Part of me says you have to question not the sanity or intelligence. I wouldn't be that mean, but anyone who holds airline stocks long term, you have to question what their goal is, because I don't think there are many that have proven to be value creators in your 401k.
Yeah, but is that, would you say that in relation to, as much as I don't like them, I mean, United Airlines stock, look at if you had purchased United Airlines stock after the bankruptcy, and what's it worth now?
That's the problem. That, I mean, quite honestly, the United stock, and you know, we've been joking that Glenn Tilton's been looking for a way out of the airline business for a long time. Which is why he's
the pilots have been trying to help him with it.
But you know, the really sad story was in the mid late 90s was the ESOP, the Employee Stock Ownership Program, at United, which, you know, post 9/11, you know, their labor relations were acrimonious there all along, but especially post bankruptcy, when you had so many employees lose their life savings to the bankruptcy process, then they were also forced to make big concessions, and then only to see the executives sort of give themselves nice handouts. It created a pretty horrible situation, and so it's no wonder the pilots were trying to help Glenn Tilton find the door. Hmm. You know, that whole sequence of events made it so you had to see United Management get cleared out in a merger or, you know, mass exodus or something for that airline to move forward, because otherwise it will be a lost generation of employees who you know, who had all been affected by this bankruptcy, who had all lost their life savings, who all hated the management. And it made its way through to the way they treated the customers. I noticed it. I used to fly quite a bit of United, and you could tell that there was an anger there.
Hmm. Well, there's always been an anger there, though. I mean, if you go back to, you mentioned the ESOP, I mean, I remember the ESOP, for those listeners that might not recall. I mean, the flight attendants were not part of the ESOP. And part of that, of course, depending on who you listen to, was related to the flight attendants themselves. But the point of the discussion is that, you know, you had your first line customer service people who were pissed off. I mean, they were really unhappy. And as a business, that is, I can't imagine anything dumber than having the people who have day-to-day contact with your customers, which the pilots essentially don't, being just really angry. And I don't think that was quite a long time ago. And that hasn't gone away. But of course,
because the airline industry is really the area where logic reigns.
Yeah.
But going back to my question, I mean, wouldn't you, if I had been one of those guys, and of course I wasn't, but if I had purchased stock out of the bankruptcy, what kind of a return would I have made?
Hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, right now United stock's up at what? Well, I'll have to look here as we're recording, because I know it's fairly well up there. But
well, Rob does that. Chris, what's the buzz in the cockpits around the world? Is there a great fear of this new combined juggernaut? Do we think that this is going to be an airline that's going to be difficult to compete with going forward, or are people just not worried about it?
The buzz that I get from the guys I know, and I know different guys at different airlines, they don't understand why Continental, which is a going concern and making money and has good morale, good equipment, good training, wants to take on this albatross around their neck. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I guess it's the numbers game. You know, Jeff Smyzik, the CEO at Continental, has said it's a big numbers game and economies of scale. But in my airline, after a huge merger with TWA that has been a disaster for us for about 8 or 9 years, I don't think it's the be-all, end-all. And a lot of folks that are at Continental worry, is this going to drag us down?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it is true that the aftermath of the TWA merger is still rancorous employee relations, a lot of agreements and exclusions. And I know United was worse than any merger we ever did, with fences and who's going to fly what. It just long term, I don't know how that works out.
Well, flight attendants still hate each other.
Yeah, and they don't forget a thing, and they don't let bygones be bygones. And speaking of that too, they have a problem with Tilton. Well, the ESOP was because they had a problem with Wolf. I mean, it goes back to whatever CEO they have a problem with them at United. So organized labor does. So I don't think it's the be all end all. Everybody's kind of wait and see. Delta seems to be doing very well in their merger, so I guess it just remains to be seen what will actually work out.
Delta did so much ahead of time, and they really did their homework. I feel like it's a model for an airline merger done right.
Yeah, because the guys over there are pretty happy, the ones I know. So,
I'm curious what types they're on.
Well, they fenced off their giant wide bodies. The 747s and the big Airbuses belong to the former Northwest guys, and the 777 flying, that international is all sticking with the Delta guys.
Legacy Delta.
Yeah. The thing that is new, though, that guys have told me, it's a kind of a revolution in the way they do business, is now they're going to be hubbing out of Amsterdam and a couple other places, to where their international flying used to be just you fly to your overnight destination and you come back 48 hours later. Now they're going to start working out of there for 6 days, just like Northwest has always done, both in the Far East and in Europe.
Yeah, I was kind of trying to piece together their A330 routing. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is that their A330-300s are essentially hubbed out of Minneapolis and Tokyo. Well, and quite a fair bit out of Honolulu. And so, you know, they'll run them across and just use them in specific ways. I think that was the 330-200s where they fly them a few destinations out of Tokyo, and then they'll go Tokyo, LA, and then one flight a day will cross over to Atlanta from LA to Atlanta, and they'll have an A330-200 in either direction, and then they move on to Amsterdam and run routes out of Amsterdam and then cycle back through Detroit for their heavy maintenance. So they've really, I mean, it's really interesting the way that they've made their routing work with their maintenance schedules.
Yeah, the Portland too is big for the Far East for Delta now.
Yeah. I don't remember if they're running 763s or 330-200s out of there.
I think it may be 777s.
No, really?
Yeah, I think so.
Huh.
Just like we do our nonstop 777 from DFW, it goes to Narita, nonstop from Chicago, Delhi, Chicago, Shanghai. It's 777.
Yeah, no, because I know they've got a couple 777 routes out of Detroit that they've opened up fairly recently. They're constantly moving stuff around, but they do Hong Kong on the 200LR. I think they do 5 weekly, something in that range out of there, and then they run, you know, to bring them back to maintenance in Atlanta, they run them in a triangle, Atlanta, Detroit, LA, to rotate out their Sydney planes, and then back to Atlanta.
Yeah, I was talking to a couple of Delta guys who they say that Portland is the ugly stepchild, that they have airplanes running out of there to the Far East on a 12-hour flight with half of the passenger entertainment systems not working, but until it goes back through Columbus or wherever it is that is their maintenance hub, those things don't get fixed. And they're saying, how can you ask people to sit in a seat for 12 hours with nothing to do?
That's not going to go over real well.
Yeah. Well, they just throw frequent flyer miles at them that they can never redeem anyway.
Yeah.
All right, well, this moves along pretty quickly now. The next milestone, and I guess this is almost the final milestone, is October 1st when the merger is completed. So they'll be off and running as of October 1st.
Yeah, I'm just looking at their fleets. You know, they each have multiple A3. Well, one's got multiple A320 variants. One's got every 737 variant they make. Hmm. You know, 757s, every model of 767, but no engine commonalities. It's just a hodgepodge.
That's an extremely expensive operating proposition.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, at least with Delta Northwest, there were economies of scale enough on both of them that it made sense. And also, you have to think that Delta's MRO facility has helped sort of pick up slack when they're trying to figure out how to get those things done. It, you know, reorganizing the maintenance setup, and you know, they always have MRO to lean on. Until they get it worked out properly.
Right.
Well, as you said, Gavin, you made a good point, too, that I can't even imagine sorting the tire stock between those two companies.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I did come up with that stock price there.
Oh, yes?
I mean, right now, as we're sitting here doing this, United's trading, it's $21.95 right now. And November of last year, it was at about $5. So that would be a pretty nice return if you'd put Max, did you put all a million of your retirement into that stock as I suggested?
I put it in Ford.
When it was
$2 a share. Go look up the current price.
There's another one, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good one. So
it definitely back in 2006 it was higher than it is now. I think it sort of topped out at 50 in 2007 and just to sort of hovered around, but things. I'm looking here at the historical pricing. It bottomed out in 2009, obviously, because everything did. But it's come back off. I mean, it bottomed out about $2.50 a share, $2 a share, in July of 2009, and I don't think anyone is particularly surprised at that date and pricing.
Right. Well, we'll see where it goes from here. I'm not going to jump in now myself, but it'd be interesting to watch.
Well, you seem fairly sane, so I would expect you not to.
Yes, yes.
See, we have an awful lot of people fooled that way.
Yeah. All right, our next item comes from the Los Angeles Times. Pilots call for changes to proposed fatigue rules. Well, the FAA proposed some new rules, proposed on September 10th. And these were kind of in response to the last year's, the February 2009 crash in Buffalo, New York, that was essentially attributed to pilot fatigue. So the new rules, they give pilots 9 hours of rest, but the clock, as I read this, the clock starts ticking when they arrive at their home or hotels after work. Whereas under the current rules, you only get 8 hours of rest, but that starts when the pilot leaves the cockpit. Well, the several of the unions, the Allied Pilots Association and the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association, say, oh, this isn't enough. This isn't going far enough. In fact, the president of the Allied Pilots Association, David Bates, said, quote, it's not enough to consistently provide pilots with the opportunity for 8 hours of sleep, which is the minimum amount dedicated by science.
Dictated by science.
Yeah, the quote says dedicated, but I think he means dictated.
I think I read dictated even though it said dedicated.
Yeah, yeah. So, Chris, what is this with you guys getting enough sleep?
Well, and that's always been the case. We always say 8 hours behind the door, meaning we will not report until we've all been at the hotel for 8 hours. But even when you have that constraint, of course, as soon as you close the hotel door, you're not sleeping. And it's a weakness in the system that the company schedules that way. Although my company, we have the crew tracking function that has me as captain call them and say, tell me when you're going to be ready tomorrow. And, you know, I kind of weigh those factors and make sure that everyone can get some rest. If you're a West Coast crew, it's not that easy to just turn it off at 7 p.m. on the East Coast, that kind of thing, you know, so individual constraints. Our company works with that pretty well. I've never been challenged when I say, here's what I think we need. But, you know, this whole NPRM, there's a huge blind spot that the union doesn't even want to take a look at. And that is actually the most underlying cause of the Buffalo crash, that both of those pilots had been commuting in, meaning they had had no sleep before they reported for duty because the FO, the first officer, came from the West Coast. I'm not sure where the captain came from, but both of them had slept in a crew lounge and they had been hopping flights all night. This doesn't even address that. I mean, and I think if they want to get serious about it, they have to have that control over the initial part of your workday. And what they do in the case of an accident, the FAA has said, we're taking a 24-hour look back. And when they look back and see, well, yeah, you had your 8 hours off, but you weren't sleeping. So this thing has a huge blind spot in it. It's more for show. But it's not going to regulate, I'd say, about 25% of the pilots are commuting in. They're not resting. If they sign in at 5 a.m., they probably got there at 3 a.m. and they left their house at midnight. So this is really, to me, eyewash. I don't think it does any good.
Is there anything to be said for, you know, one of the things that we've heard is that in terms of the scope clause that the United and Continental pilots have managed to carve out, really bringing more flying back on mainline, is that going to reduce the amount of regional flying to the extent that we'll see some of the less experienced pilots, or we'll see fewer regional pilots? And in a way, it sort of reduces the industry that you can sort of regionalize the pilot bases and sort some of this stuff out.
I doubt it, because it seems like in every major airline, and ours is typical of most, the marketing department can't decide 90 days in advance what they want to do. I don't know that there'll ever be stability in that kind of a matchup of schedule, fleet, and pilot. I've about given up on that whole idea, because our international, our union, which is Dave Bates and Allied Pilots Association, proposed, how about if we schedule our international crews 2 months at a time so everybody could get really accommodated to the schedule? And they just said, you know, realistically, marketing can't even decide exactly what we need to do that far in advance. I kind of would doubt that'd be – it'd be wonderful in a perfect world, but I doubt it.
Which is quite incredible, because so much of your flying is done to slot-constrained airports, meaning your schedule is set not by marketing but by the by when you have a landing time.
Yeah, exactly. Especially the track systems too, because you got to stay on those North Atlantic tracks, and you better be on time.
Can I play devil's advocate for a minute here, guys? Because having flown for a living too, although I don't anymore, I did commute for a short while, and for whatever it's worth, for those people that don't do it, it's a terrible thing. It's just awful. But now tell me, how can the airline get in the middle of that whole discussion about where you live and not bring a ton of bricks down on themselves? Because wouldn't they get an awful lot of grief about, well, you pay such lousy wages, we can't live anywhere else? And the airline says, well, look, kid, this is the best we can do. If you don't like it, lump it. And I mean, how could we open that box of worms and be successful with it? I guess I'm just curious.
What's interesting is that flight was a Colgan flight, which I think was a contract carrier. American owns American Eagle, and Delta owns a big chunk of its subsidiaries, and most of the other a very large portion of the rest of the regional flying is done by big sort of consolidated regional carriers. So I don't know whether, you know, yes, there were problems, but I don't know whether the problems that ended up with that flight were a sort of an amalgamation of a whole bunch of little things that turned into a crash.
Well,
is it an outlier? Is it sort of a worst case scenario?
It was a bad combination, but again, the big hammer is the FAA takes a 24-hour look back, and they said marked that both of those pilots had no sleep before they reported to work, and the first officer was sick. But that being the case, nobody's even talking about commuting or anything. They're saying, well, we'll see if we can get you 9 hours behind the door, and we're going to completely ignore what you do before you show up for work, which may be very well sitting in the back of an airplane trying to get to work for the last 8 hours.
Yeah.
So it just has this huge blind spot. And I just don't see where – we don't have a problem. I don't, because anytime I say to tracking, I think we need to show up at 7 a.m. because we just got in here and it's 10 p.m. They don't say a word. They're like, that's great. We'll fix it. So I'm not sure how the other airlines run, but ours is very sensitive about that look back after we had that one fatigue accident in Little Rock back in 96?
Maybe it's the sort of dark side of contract flying is that they don't have to. It gets kicked down the road, and it's there's an argument from the marketing carrier that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing.
Yeah,
there's a 60-day comment period, so folks have the opportunity to give some feedback to the FAA. And according to this article, the final rule gets adopted in August 2011. So hopefully, there's some sanity will come to this in the next 60 days.
Now, I have a question, Chris. Would you be in favor of a system that sort of allocated hours based on cruise time versus approach, takeoff, landing? Because it would seem to me that a long haul flight you're going to have sort of heightened activity and heightened stress at the beginning, at the end, but a 10-hour international flight from Chicago to Narita isn't going to be much more in combined stressful than a transcon from New York to LA for the pilot. Is there any value to that logic?
Well, I suppose, but again, I think too, then you end up with this huge circadian flip flop that is aggravated by being as far away as Narita. And, I'd argue that the commuter guy who's flying up and down the East Coast is probably more tired than the guy who just flew to Narita. But then you've got this huge circadian flip flop that goes on when you have the international guy. So I would think, and I think Rob alluded to it, the science of this should be what takes precedence or takes priority, and I'm not sure that they really have a good handle on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Next item comes from Air Transport World. This is Boeing assails European characterization of WTO ruling. Now, purely by coincidence, the last time Chris was on, we talked about the WTO report concerning subsidies and Airbus. And we also mentioned back then that of course, there was the issue of the same idea with Boeing. And the WTO has provided some information concerning this. And, as expected, the WTO is saying that Boeing has received some unfair advantage, largely as a result of contracts from the government, specifically NASA. Boeing is saying, well, this is not exactly the same thing as the subsidies that the WTO found were improper with regards to Airbus. But, now we have the stage kind of getting set for, I don't know what, maybe the negotiated settlement.
I just think it's really funny that somehow Airbus managed to get a copy of it and read it and comment on it before the thing was released. I mean, Boeing's in a bit of a bind there because, they probably have a copy or they might not have a copy of the report. But all of a sudden, Airbus is getting to pick and choose what it wants to put out there, and Boeing is forced to play defense before the thing's even released. I see where Airbus's argument is. I mean, I think I remember that the 777 was somehow born out of some NASA grant. You know, I'm struggling to figure out how the linkage between NASA and a two-engined ultra wide-bodied airliner. But things like winglets, I think blended winglets were one of the things that came out of NASA research. Although I think they've been around quite a while.
Mm.
And I think Airbus might have started using them first. I think the A330 probably was the first commercial airliner with some sort of blended winglet or wing fence. Yeah. But I guess the launch aid and loans that Airbus receives are a little more blatant than
seem to be, at least from this side of the pond.
Yeah, at least from this side of the pond.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is that is what's sort of panning out with the A380 and Emirates and a lot of European carriers, specifically those in France and Germany, getting very, very frustrated because they're having their pockets picked by Middle Eastern carriers who are buying European planes that their governments are funding with massive discounts, and things aren't breaking even. So basically, EU subsidies are going to pay for planes that are picking EU carriers' pockets.
Well, to me, besides the sort of, spat between Boeing and Airbus trying to maximize their position, to me, the real important thing about this is the implications for the Bombardiers and COMACs and others like that around the world who are, I think, kind of looking to see if there aren't some guidelines or some policies concerning subsidies, because they don't want to, I think, get in a situation down the road where they find themselves hauled before the WTO for illegal subsidies.
What's interesting is that I feel like Bombardier won't start getting any flack until the C-Series starts flying. And then Boeing and Airbus will start coming in. Well, did they get illegal subsidies? Because it just doesn't suit Boeing and Airbus to go after Bombardier right now because they're not feeling the threat yet.
No, I agree. I think that if you're trying to inflict damage on your competitor, you don't raise the flag too early. Wait a little, really cause some serious pain.
Yeah, exactly. Airbus definitely has more to lose at this point because they're busy trying to develop the A350. Which I think they've had launch aid allocated to them, but it hasn't been deployed and it's part of this whole argument. And so they're sort of teetering on the edge where, they want to start developing the A350, but it's are they going to get the launch aid or they're not going to get the launch aid?
Yeah. Okay. Rob had an item about a field in Chicago, I think, Rob.
It's a dirt field. Actually, it's sort of a dirt and grass field. We used to call it Chicago Megs.
And then Richard Daley got out there in the middle of the night, right?
For those listeners who may not have heard this story, Chicago Megs was the little airport down just to the east edge of Chicago's downtown area, right on the lake. And the mayor didn't like it, never did. Actually, I don't really think the mayor of Chicago cares much about the airlines either, other than the passenger facility charges that he gets from them.
Hmm.
But he certainly is unkind to general aviation. And one night he just had enough and took his bulldozers in there and cut big X's on the runway with the backhoes. And that was the end of that airport. But it might just come back.
How did he get away with that?
You caught his last name, right?
yeah. And Mayor Daley, owed the city of Chicago owed FAA a couple million dollars in money for federal improvements that were put on the airport, and somebody in Mayor Daley's office got the bright idea that they said, well, if we just paid you the money back, then you wouldn't have any complaints about what we do, right? And Jane Garvey, who was the administrator at the time, somebody in her office said, yeah, I guess not. So the city cut the FAA a check for whatever the outstanding amount of money was that the FAA had loaned to the airport for improvements. And the mayor said, well, you know what? Now it's my airport, and I'll do whatever I want. And that was the end.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. They got a little fine. I think they got fined $30,000 for not notifying users in a timely manner I mean, I think there were probably a dozen airplanes that were caught on the ground at Meigs with no way to take off other than they eventually used the parallel taxiway to get these airplanes off. But
were they GA or were they airlines?
Yeah, well, they were GA. There really wasn't any airline service in there.
That's about a 3,000-foot runway, isn't it?
Yeah, it was 3,900 feet.
Yeah.
And so there were turboprops that used to go in there. Some of the commuters used to go in, but there wasn't anything other than that. And they used to have a lot of airplanes that never quite got stopped in time and went off the end of the runway into the water. So it was an exciting place.
Yeah,
But it was a useful airport because there were an awful lot of people that flew into Chicago in business airplanes. And I mean, you could take a corporate jet in and out of there if it was light enough, but they would go into downtown and it was a 5-minute taxi ride from Meigs to the center of the business community.
Pretty convenient.
Oh, that's the same way Kansas City, you know, right? That
exactly.
One right downtown, Cleveland, yeah. Right on the water, New Orleans, right on the water.
Orleans, yeah. Right, that same thing.
Yeah.
And so there is this someone has put two and two together and come up with five. I'm not certain I agree with this, but when President Obama was in Milwaukee for Labor Day, he made some comments about adding some cash to infrastructure work, including airports, and somehow someone has read between the lines and thinks that means that he might be willing to help open Meigs, reopen Meigs. And I'm not quite certain I see that unless there's some particular fact that I'm missing, but I don't know that that's going to happen. It's great theater, though.
Hmm.
Well, maybe when his chief of staff becomes the mayor of Chicago, the connection will work.
Well, you know, that's a good point. I mean, and boy, we're going to have quite a number of people running for mayor here pretty soon.
Any chance that the former governor?
You mean Rod Blagojevich?
Yeah.
Actually, he doesn't need to run because what he did is he appointed himself mayor.
Ah.
He realizes that the mark of a true politician is that you don't need no stinking voters.
Again, our guest this episode is Chris Mano, an airline captain, a blogger at Jethead. Chris, that's at jethead.wordpress.com, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
And also still doing the cartooning, right, at flighttruezoo.com?
Yeah, there's a lot of those on the blog as well.
Fantastic. Well, you know, one thing that we talked about last week was this notion about how many pilots do you really need in the cockpit? And, you know, I think this was sparked by O'Leary's, recent brilliant idea that aircraft are so automated these days that there really isn't enough work in there for two pilots. And so we might as well just reduce it to one and save a lot of money. Well, Chris, does that make a lot of sense?
It would if everything were nominal, if it were a simple matter of simply getting into the air and getting on the ground. But what he's advocating is almost like saying, you know, we experience a fire in about 10% of our office building. So if we put an extinguisher on every 10th floor, we should be covered and we'll just take the risk, because it's in the extraordinary circumstances and it's in the critical circumstances, which of course happen in every flight and takeoff and approach and landing, that you can't really do it with one. And in fact, the state of the art and the science of it now is to compartmentalize some of the critical duties so that the first and most important duty, being flying the airplane, is never neglected, no matter whether you're having a difficult approach or an emergency situation.
Right.
So the problem I see, the technique that we use that works so well, like in a Category 3 approach, which is down to a decision height of 300 feet, the duties are completely separated between me as captain and the first officer, who is doing all the instrument looking. He's watching all the tolerances on pitch bank and roll RMP, and I'm outside looking. So I'm cocked to the landing position. He is completely in the go-around position, and whoever – if I see the runway, we land. If I don't, we're on the go. But if you're the stop and go at the same time, you're sorting this stuff out at a 300-foot ceiling. It just doesn't work with one guy, and that's not even counting emergency situations.
You know,
yeah, that's what I was going to say, too, in emergencies. I mean, I can only remember even training times where we would, you know, they would throw all kinds of incredible emergencies at you. And all you knew is that when you got down on the ground, you'd say, boy, thank God I had a good person in the right seat, because a good person in the right seat can make you or break you. The flying part's almost easy compared to running all the checklists and making sure everything else gets done. But I can't imagine how anybody could think that one person could handle all that.
You posted there was a question after an episode last week or the week before, a few weeks ago, about pilotless planes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's at the margins. It's where flights are not normal, that having well-trained pilots and having pilots at all makes the big difference. I mean, you look at obviously Sully, have a computer or a single pilot plane do what he did. You know, his right seat, he gets all the credit, but you know that the guy in the right seat played.
Jeff Skiles, might I add.
Hi, Dan.
Hey,
I see Dan as well.
Hi.
Dan Webb has joined us.
Just wanted to add the name.
Yeah. I mean, the guy doesn't get enough credit because the British Airways 777 that, you know, semi-crash landed at Heathrow, both pilots, you know, were clearly involved there. And then a little known incident out of Johannesburg about a couple months ago with British Airways that resulted in a very close call that we never heard about anything. If you had one pilot in there or it was an automated thing, you know, between those three incidents, we're talking about 600 to 700 fatalities that were all averted because you had two well-trained pilots in the cockpit.
Well, and I need to be able to divide that up, because if I take off from LaGuardia tomorrow with a Super 80, I already know that we're at a critical weight when we're leaving there because of the shortness of the runway. I have about a half a second to decide, do we have enough speed to take off in the case of an engine failure, or if not, can I stop it on the runway? And those points occur in a split second that also you have to make the decision that is whatever I'm aborting for going to affect my ability to stop, which would be electrics, hydraulics, or anti-skid. And so what I do, and it requires two of us, is the first officer is doing the takeoff, and I tell him we're not stopping except for the big four, which is engine fire, engine failure, structural damage, or reported or detected wind shear, period. So he is on the go. He is a go guy. He's not thinking about stopping. I'm the stop guy, but I can only do that. And that way, all I have to do is look for the big four. Otherwise, I know we're airborne. If I'm the stop and the go guy, and then he doesn't know what's going on, you can't do that single pilot. And it's a level of safety that we absolutely need, because now I have one thing to think about. And just like in the landing in the critical situation, he has one thing to think about. And the benefit to that is that we're all on task, specializing, rather than trying to muddle all these things together.
Chris, do you have a different first officer each flight, or do you guys team up, pair up for multiple flights? How does that work?
Well, we're paired up for the month, but then we all can swap. We can go in the computer, and if you see, we're supposed to fly Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and very often I'll say, oh, geez, I needed Wednesday off, so I'm going to back it up, and so I'll trade with somebody else. So we're very often flying with a different person each flight.
Because the reason I'm asking is I'm finding myself wondering, to what degree does the function in the cockpit, the combination of the two pilots, rely on knowing each other really well? And I'm thinking about cop shows on TV where, you have a partner and you work together as a team on a kind of a personal level. Does the same thing happen in the cockpit? Sounds like probably not.
I don't think so. I feel like standardization is like every single one of us. I could step into that cockpit with anybody and I already know what they're going to do. That is the big push in flight training of all, airlines, is standardization, to where it doesn't matter who sits down in that seat. And I've had it where guys are out of time, they're out of their flight time, and a new guy plugs in. We just go. It's going to be fine. It's not going to be a problem.
And that's an incredible
and that's the reason they do that, because you don't want either pilot to have to try to figure out what a particular individual's foibles are. I mean, you just want to know that, man, if number two catches fire when you're 400 feet in the air, that everybody's going to do the same thing.
And exactly.
They're going to do what you think they're going to do.
Exactly. Yeah. There has to be a litany that we all know what's going to happen.
So what I'm thinking is, what if that number two is a computer somewhere?
Or a power source. Electrical problems, the computers aren't working without electricity. And the absolute first memory item in any type of electrical malfunction is to start isolating all the systems and depowering everything. Because the problem is, if you were to bring a backup online and it was a distribution bus that was a problem, you're going to lose that too. And without power sources, computers ain't flying.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that British Airways incident, you had a computer, a faulty wiring situation where on takeoff out of Johannesburg, the thrust reversers deployed, the computer thought the thrust reversers deployed, and it caused a retraction in the leading edge flaps. And a computer is not going to pick that up. The computer is not going to realize that that's an erroneous input. There's no way that could be.
Yeah, they can't write every contingency into the plan.
Exactly.
They just can't. It can't be done. I don't think. It's too complex.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys have read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, any of you?
No. Know of it. Yeah. Yeah. I know where you're going.
Because there was a really interesting section about captain first officer communications and relationships and cultural discrepancies between different countries and different cultures. And I know he got a lot of flack. And there were a lot of people who had their noses bent out of shape, and I'm not sure where the truth is. But what he was writing about was the relationship between first officer and co-pilot. And it's really – I'm surprised that someone who ran an airline like David O'Leary, who should be familiar with the procedures in a cockpit and should be familiar with the way things function when – something goes wrong, would say something that outlandish and quite frankly irresponsible.
Is crazy a prerequisite for the job, though?
Sorry?
Is crazy a prerequisite for the job, though?
Yeah, it's not. Hey, that's John Ostrower, who's just joined us.
Surprise.
Hi, John.
Hey.
John, you know, we're talking about O'Leary and, you know, the notion that you only need one pilot in the cockpit and so forth. From a journalist standpoint, how is O'Leary person? I mean, did they take O'Leary seriously?
Well, no. that's the short answer.
Can you elaborate on that, John?
I'd be happy to. I think that, you know, we sort of the aviation journalist corps sort of collectively rolls its eyes when he says crazy stuff like that, because we know exactly that he's a marketing genius, and he knows that whenever he says crazy stuff, someone in the Daily Mail or
Telegraph.
The Telegraph or, you know, any number of U.S. newspapers are going to be like, oh, there goes that crazy CEO making crazy statements again. And he knows full well that EASA, FAA, and Boeing aren't ever going to let him fly a 737-800 with one pilot. It doesn't exist. It doesn't happen. And it's against the law. So, you know, I think that there's a very, very distinct line between the media that just eats this stuff up because they know they get page clicks for websites and get, you know, eyeballs on stories. And then the rest of us who are like, oh God, will you please just stop talking? You know,
and then we can't help ourselves. And then we talk about it here.
Well, exactly. But I think, you know, we saw it just this last week in Long Beach, where this Italian company unveils these stand-up seats. I'm not sure if you guys talked about this earlier.
No, I was going to ask Chris about that.
I saw those.
Chris, did you see that?
The saddle seats.
Yeah, the saddle
seats. I did. I'm like,
they're
oh
so
God.
Uncomfortable.
You tried them, John?
I did. And I'm not that tall of a person. I'm hovering right around 5'10". And Mary Kirby is about 6 feet tall, and she tried it and she was miserable. But I'm 5'10", and I was not they're not ergonomically correct for the shape of a person's body. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
They're not to mention your with a 23-inch pitch, you literally feel like your face is up against the table, the seat back in front of you. And you know the folks at Avio actually had an answer for every question we had. And even no matter how absurd the answers were when they actually came out. Like I said, okay, how do you survive a head strike with the front of the seat so close to you in front of you?
Yeah.
Well, they say, because the seat is closer to you, you'll have actually less kinetic energy because you won't be going as fast in the deceleration. So it's actually safer than if the seat was farther away.
Wow. Yeah, because your head's not traveling as far.
Well, yeah, but I mean...
the physics makes sense, at least.
Physics makes sense, but...
But yeah, I know. It's kind of Chris, you know, if seats like this or some method by which people could fly standing up or nearly so could be made, you know, so that it was comfortable enough that passengers would accept it, or at least some of them would.
But that's the problem with the airline industry. because some crazy airline will do that, sell tickets for less, get away with it, and then next thing you know, all the mainline carriers will be using them. And it's not market forces don't rule in the airline industry. It's what the carriers can get away with. It's quite unbelievable.
Well, that's actually, I think, the one thing that's working in the favor of the consumer. What they can get away with. I mean, that one of the things that they showed was an A321 with a 220 passenger configuration. 220 people on an A321. It's a lot. It's also illegal, which they didn't mention. The A321, I believe, is only certified up to max passengers at 210. So the configuration that they have, even putting these in, it's not legal. You could put stand-up seats in, which probably weigh less than a regular seat, so there's a weight benefit there. But to put them in, you probably have something like 40 inches of pitch because you ended up having to spread them out anyway. Because it's not just a matter of how many people you have nose to tail; it's how many people you have between exits. So,
yeah. Right. Isn't that the driver? How quickly you can empty the
configuration?
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's a complete non-starter in terms of safety.
But come on, isn't this really the O'Leary of aviation seating?
I mean,
come on, John. I know somebody else that was out there and sent me a video of that I put up on Twitter. And I said, come on, Matt Thurber that I work with. And I said, Matt, come on. This was a joke, right? I mean, they know they're not going to get people to ride on these things. I mean, look at the distances you mentioned between the on the seat pitch. I mean, a normal person – If the normal person were even in the middle, how in God's name would they even squeeze between the back of the seat in front of them enough to get to a seat of their own?
I'm just surprised someone other than Dan said seat pitch.
Well, Dan's been working with me.
Well, no, your wife actually, your lovely, beautiful wife.
Yes, actually, the therapy is well, you know, the therapy and the drugs and the alcohol have all finally started to take their. You know, there are grateful places in my life, and it's
oh, in your life, straight. Okay. But I'm going to disagree with something that Gavin said, though, about market forces. I think a lot of times, and rightly so, the airline industry, it's viewed as a race to the bottom in terms of having the lowest fare possible. And that's true. I mean, there are airlines that obviously go for the lowest cost, lowest fare, and like the Ryanairs and the Spirits of the world. But there are airlines that do sell on product. I mean, Singapore, would probably be the biggest example. But, I mean, airlines, U.S. domestic, have been making product enhancements. I mean, Delta has Wi-Fi in pretty much the entire domestic fleet. Now, granted, it's ancillary revenue opportunity. But now for Delta, I forget what their due date was, but I think the new policy is any flight that's over 750 miles, even if it's an RJ, has to have a first class. And airlines, you know, I mean, JetBlue was founded on the basis of having a superior product than other carriers out there. So I think in a lot of cases, there is a race to the bottom with price, but I think sometimes product is overlooked as well.
The thing that I'm looking to is the baggage fees, where people were griping and moaning and furious, but they still pervaded the industry. You know, they still got through. It didn't matter that people, you know, went out of their way to fly airlines that didn't charge them. It didn't matter that frequent flyers and elite frequent flyers griped and moaned and lodged their complaints with the carriers. These things still came in because they realized they could get away with them.
Well, partly they're going to get away with them, but also, I mean, the frequent flyers who the airlines are, who they really care about, they're not really going to complain about this, since basically every airline, at least U.S. domestic, if you're elite, you're going to be exempt from the bag fees.
Yeah.
But I'd say a couple things. We've seen a couple airlines that I think have made their fee policies, especially with bags, a little bit better. Like Alaska really standardized everything. And actually, Frontier actually has lowered their second bag fee. So the first and second bag are both $20. And they said, we're doing this, and I can get the official response in a second. The reason they did it is this makes things simpler for the traveler. And also, they say it makes them more competitive compared to other low-cost carriers, which we can debate about that. But, yeah.
I guess just kind of jump in here from a different kind of perspective and just kind of how the airlines respond to each other. Because I think there's an element here about how those that build and design aircraft actually structure their entire businesses, because as the race to the bottom continues and the margins are so low on the operation side, if you're actually the one putting the plane together, it becomes a very, very hard sell to say, okay, well, you made a razor thin margin. Now you need to buy new airplanes, you know, mm-hmm. and how do you structure that, in terms of your own business model and making sure you're delivering a good product for a not unreasonable price. And Boeing and Airbus have differed in this respect, that Boeing will say, hey, we offer our products for a little bit more for a greater value. And Airbus says, well, we can compete on cost and we'll sell slightly less capability or some compromise there for less. And consistently, I think the market is probably split about, whether it's 48-52 or 58-4, or 48-52 or 48-52 the other way, it really varies by carrier, but how you structure that is going to be very interesting, because as you get into, the Bombardier getting in the game and Comac and the Brazilians and the Russians, everyone is going to have a different business model they can compete on, and what the airlines want, I think, is the big question for how they actually satisfy these crazy business models of their own.
Now, I don't know if any of you read, back in about 2003, there was a whole drawn-out article the Wall Street Journal did about the wide-body competition at Iberia, between the A340-600 and the 777-300ER, and how each company was making their bids. And I'm now, after what John just said, I'm curious to go back and read it again. Given his sort of crystallization of the methodologies that each of the airframers use.
I'll have to find that.
Yeah, I think I've got it in a PDF somewhere in my Gmail account. I'll send it out.
Well, actually, I would be curious to get a pilot's view on kind of next generation fly-by-wire. When I was in Brazil last week, they were showing us a demo of their new fly-by-wire system, which essentially is a hybrid system between Airbus and Boeing philosophies. You have envelope protection, but you have it only when there is a potential for structural damage. So you can theoretically roll the airplane as long as you're not stressing the
keep 1G on it.
So it's an interesting balance. And I tried out their engineering simulator. And I tried in direct mode, and I stamped on the rudder and the whole thing, yawed to the side, and I flipped over. Well, it turned on the new flight control laws, and you slam on it, and it'll only deflect a couple of degrees off center line.
I have the natural pilot skepticism of all that, and ever since then, I know you've seen the video of the Airbus in Toulouse, I guess it was, at the air show when they were they flew it controlled flight into the terrain because the computer said, no, you don't really want to pull that hard, and you sure don't want to overboost these engines.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've always had that suspicion, and I flew the F-100 for a number of years, and one of the biggest things that what you'd hear in the cockpit is, what is it doing now? So we would have to completely strip it of all electronics to gain control of it again. So I don't know. Maybe it's just my normal pilot skepticism and about 17,000 flight hours, but I really cringe, and I would really rather the engineers told me less of what they're doing, because I still have to live with it.
Well, what's interesting is that they studied that accident, and the way they looked at it was from the perspective of a lot of the accidents they've seen have been in relation to auto thrust versus throttle. That obviously being the big debate between Airbus and Boeing, and that Airbus, that Boeing is going, or the Embraer is going an auto throttle route for essentially a visual and tactile cue to the pilot about where the engines are. And it's obviously you kind of lock up the thrust levers on Airbus, and you just leave it at that detent and let it go. And it kind of does its own thing. So obviously there's a difference in philosophy there, but it seems the new Embraer philosophy really takes the best of both worlds, and it's a very interesting system. But it certainly it really flies in the face of everything that I was taught. Flying a 172, if you're going to do a crosswind, all they want is that all you have to use is rudder with no aileron whatsoever. It'll just automatically.
I've seen that. Yeah. And I've seen that, and it actually does a great job, because it actually does two things that most pilots don't do. It rolls it in a coordinated fashion. But again, it'll get into the sampling rate of the real time reporting that it's getting from actual crosswind as to whether or not it actually can perform that in all cases. And I worry a little bit about that in the rate of cycling of that information into the computer. So yeah, it's a little bit scary to think about. We'll use it when it gets in the field, but the human factors, like we found out with the F-16, you better put some movement in that stick because people have to know what they're doing. They have to have the feel of what they're doing.
Exactly.
Where you can't isolate the pilot from the airplane too much.
Exactly. The human factors, because you will lose your involvement in very complex Cat 3 or whatever type of balanced field stuff you're doing. You're going to lose the pilot out of that loop. It's just it's not engaged if it doesn't have that tactile or the physicality of it. You just can't keep that up, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's interesting is that I got to debate with someone who said, why do we even need a pilot? With only my 43 and a half hours under my belt, I got kind of defensive.
If you got that defensive after 43 and a half hours, imagine what Chris would do.
I think it goes back to electrical power. You are going to screw up the electrical power in an airplane eventually, and no box is working. And everybody says, well, we'll have additional power sources. It's like you will not have redundant distribution sources.
Right.
And sooner or later, someone is going to have that unpowered airplane with a bunch of bodies in it, and that won't be a good idea.
Well, exactly. And you come back to that, and you say, well, okay, 50% of all accidents are caused by pilot error, then get rid of the pilot. But except that that one accident, you got to train, you start building airplanes around pilots rather than the other way around.
Well, and it's that logic.
You have
they say
people like O'Leary though that make those kinds of comments about the fact that you only need one pilot or no pilots or whatever, and people like him look at the statistics of automobiles and say, look, we knock off. I think in the States, what do we knock off, 30 or 40,000 people a year still in automobile right. accidents, and nobody even cares. So he's thinking, hey, listen, come on, when you get right down to it, what's 100? So it's 150 people. In the statistical world, it's not that big a deal. And unfortunately, sometimes there are people after a while that listen to him and go, well, maybe the guy's got something there. That's what's really scary, I think.
Mm. I'd have to say, being a devil's advocate, though, I am kind of surprised there hasn't been unmanned or single-man cargo operations because, again, the boxes are not quite the same as 100 bodies. So
maybe that's where it will start.
Technology that's out there.
It wouldn't surprise me if that came in when Boeing, fully implemented the blended wing body model.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if that those two things coincided.
Interesting.
Cargo, I don't know why that hasn't happened. The first UCAV has made a flight unaccompanied from Edwards to Australia, with a load of boxes. I don't think it's that big a deal, unless it falls on your house. But
you don't know why this hasn't happened? It's called ALPA.
But that's not an – oh, yeah, I guess it is an airline.
Yeah. FedEx.
Well, yeah, I was going to say the FedEx UPS argument. FedEx could do it, UPS couldn't.
Yeah.
From an operating cost perspective, yeah, it would probably make sense. But, then there is reality.
Right.
Which is why
we're comparing cars to automobiles. And I'd make the argument that good pilots have saved more lives eking out bad situations than good drivers have.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
So think about that, John, when you're on that flight back to Sao Paulo or something like that, and the flight attendant wakes you up and says, Mr. Ostrauer, did you happen to have your logbook with you tonight? we could use you up front for just a few minutes.
Well, I think every airplane geek ever has sat in an airplane wondering, praying that maybe just someday, sometime, the world will need them to land that 777. I know Dan has.
Yeah, except my experience is Flight Simulator 2004, an X-Plane for iPad. So I'm just going to be honest. With the current situation, everyone would die anyway.
our recent 757 where the first officer became incapacitated and they brought a flight attendant up?
Yes, right.
The captain on that, who did a tremendous job, actually was having it set up for auto land because the guy had the forethought to think, we lost our first officer. If I have a coronary right now, we're all there. Everyone's dead. He set it up for auto land. They didn't need it, but that's really good thinking because that is. If you're down to a single pilot, you're screwed. Yeah. He realized he is the single pilot, and I mean, it's one in a bazillion that all of a sudden he's going to have a heart attack, but he did set it up for Autoland for exactly that reason.
Yeah, because you've got no margin left.
There's nothing left. And if you take off with that margin, and again, everything you know from when you, what flying you've done as a crew, it's challenge and response. That way we divide it up. One is attending to it. One is cross-checking it. You just eliminate all that when you say single pilot, which I just don't see how you can do that.
Yeah.
Chris, I have a question. Is it true that when you're heading into a sort of more stressful situation, you know, approach to landing or you know, crowded airspace, that the least experienced pilot is always at the controls?
No, not necessarily. I would, like I said, in the case of a critical takeoff, even though I've got a lot more experience than the FO, I make him do the takeoff so that I can be attending to other things. And I think that's probably what you're getting at. It is probably better to have eyeballs out. And a lot of guys in an emergency situation as captain always want the other guy to fly because they want their mind 100% on the emergency. So I see where you're going, and that is a good point. I'd even go so far as to say if I see an accident as a witness and I've got like 17,000 flight hours and somebody who's got 20 hours sees the same accident, they're actually going to be the better witness because I got too many biases, too many things I know I saw. And so, you know, there's value in that. And I think you're probably a better pilot earlier in your career because it is critical. I mean, you are wide awake and eyeballs out. So there's a lot to that.
All right. Well, Chris, you know, with a cast of characters like we have here today, we could go on for, I think, hours and hours and hours, and we don't want to hold you up too much longer. Is there anything else that you can think of that's kind of on the minds of pilots, airline pilots these days?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that worries everyone that's in the business, I'm sure, and passengers as well, is that it's gotten to where it's moved away from being about flying. Airlines have become more about product and marketing, and it's getting away from the fundamentals. And that would be fine if the product wasn't moving at 500 miles an hour and 5 miles up in the sky. But we all feel a little bit of a worry that it's trying to be, in the management sense, commodified. O'Leary is an extreme example, but all airlines, and necessarily so for survival, have had to become a lot more commodified, a lot less about flight and a lot more about product and production and cost. And that's a little worrisome. And that's just, I'm sure that is the way it is. So there's nothing we can do about it, but that is my big concern.
It's kind of a shame. I mean, we long for the flight experiences we used to have and just the whole, aura around flying.
Well, you know, for me and for most pilots, you get behind closed doors. We will say it's a great job once the door is closed. Once you've pushed back, now we get to do what we do. But there is so much now on the ground in between, so much pain for passengers, so much difficulty, cost, maintenance. But once you close that door and aim it skyward, it's still the same. It's a great, great world still.
All right. Well, Chris, we'd like to thank you for coming back on the show again. And as we mentioned, you can find Chris's blog, Jethead, at www.jethead.wordpress.com. And we didn't really talk about tonight, but also Chris pens some really amusing cartoons based on experiences of pilots and flight attendants and crew and so forth. And that's at www.flightcrewzoo.com. Chris, any other ways people can follow you online, or primarily through those two?
No, those two are pretty much it, and it's always a pleasure to be with you guys. You have a great discussion, and I enjoy all the voices and all the information and all the experiences you all have. Thanks for sharing.
Great. Thanks again for coming on the show.
All right. Well, thank you.
John, since we have you here, what can you tell us about the 787 program these days? What's the latest?
Never heard of it.
Never heard
of it. It's been delayed.
Yes, so I hear. Right now, airplane number one is back flying again. It had an engine surge on the 10th of September, returned to flying on Friday. All seems okay on that front. I tend to think an engine surge won't have a real long-term effect on the flight test program.
No damage to the engine as a result of the surge?
Well, they did swap out the engine, so we weren't really sure exactly what the extent was, but clearly it was enough of a concern that they swapped it out. Right now, the fleet is kind of is a bit spread out. Airplane 4 is still in Victorville. Airplane 5 is in Seattle. Airplane 1 is in Roswell still. Airplane 3, I believe, is in Mesa. I want to say it's in. That sounds right. But yeah, I mean, they're progressing through the hours. Obviously, you combine the fact that, you know, Rolls-Royce wasn't able to ship the engines as fast as they needed to for Airplane 9 to get the ETOPS stuff started. You know, obviously things are going to slide into the middle of first quarter. I think the industry consensus is there may be another shoe to drop here, but I think that it's all very hard to tell based on where they are today and whether or not they've actually bought themselves a bit of breathing room with this latest delay that they announced on the 27th of August. So I think it'll be very interesting to see kind of how the rest of the year plays out moving forward. But I think kind of even looking even more broadly, I'm actually putting out a piece tomorrow that's pretty much a fall preview for the aerospace industry. And I am of the mind that the next 3 months and 2 weeks will probably decide the next 10 years of commercial aerospace, and which is, quite a statement, I know. But when you think about Boeing's re-engineering decision, Airbus's re-engineering decision, Embraer's re-engineering decision, orders for the C-Series that may or may not come, future Gulfstream products that may or may not be announced, future Bombardier business jet products that will take on the G650, the strike at Cessna, will they relaunch the Columbus? I think this is all, you know, the remainder of 2010 is really going to decide the path moving forward.
So basically pretty boring, right?
Yeah.
Basically pretty boring.
Hey, John, getting back to the 787, the Rolls-Royce engines, was there any commonality between the engine surge that happened on Airplane 1 and the uncontained failure at the Rolls factory?
As far as we know, no. From what I understand, that most engine surges happen in the compressor section of the engine. The failure that happened on August 2nd at Rolls-Royce was a failure of the intermediate turbine. So, which is in the back part of the engine. So it's a different part of the beast, so to speak.
Okay, so I'd say that's probably a good thing for Rolls that there's not any commonality between those two.
Well, no, they're just two issues.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
well, I, not to mention, I shouldn't. I mean, just that was tongue in cheek, but I mean, the compressor stalls happen. I mean, they happen on in-service airplanes all the time. It's not hugely consequential. You know, if you get one compressor stall over, you know, the life of the flight test program when the engines are still maturing, then yeah, I mean, it happens.
John, I have a serious question now. So what's up with in the sense of well, actually, since these have been problems with the Rolls powered aircraft, what's up with the GE powered? I mean, the only reason I ask is I think Continental is right now the only carrier to announce a legit 787 route. Well, two actually. So I guess with both of those starting in November, do you still think they'll be able to make that?
Well, I think they've given themselves a lot of buffer in there. When Continental first announced the route, they said they were going to take their first delivery in August. So they would have August, September, October, November before they started the New Zealand and Lagos routes. I think that'll be really interesting to see whether or not they can, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw a Newark Houston route with a 787 to start next summer for pilot training, which I expect all of you to join me on at least at some point next year.
As long as you're paying.
Oh, you know, I'll see what I can do. But, you know, it would just be, you know, pilot training and pilot familiarization and all that. So if you start cutting that buffer down, it does become more difficult when you've shown your cards. Your planning gets to be a bit harder. But the one airline that hasn't announced, number one, their configuration or their first routes is ANA. They still haven't come out and said how they're going to be packing them in. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out, and whether or not ANA will announce a route with a potentially still flexible delivery date for the 787 in mind.
And that ANA route starts, I believe, mid-2008, correct?
May of 2008, yes.
Yeah. We need to listen to some Australians, but has anyone got anything just burning that we've got to get out before
we haven't gotten to talk about Southwest and the 738 or the Spirit IPO.
Yeah, Dan, pick one.
Oh crap. Gavin, do you have a coin?
Yes.
All right. Go. Heads is Spirit IPO.
Heads it is.
Okay, beautiful.
This is professional podcasting for all you listening.
Actually, very quick. Southwest, the leadership of the Transport Workers Union 556 unanimously approved a tentative agreement with the companies that would allow them to begin flying the 737-800. The TA is now going to union membership, who will be voting yay or nay. But this isn't. I mean, this is a big step. But I think the bigger issue is Southwest has to talk with its pilots, because about 70, 80 737-800 seats, about the same as like 100 700s. But for flight attendants, because the 800 needs the fourth flight attendant, it would come out about the same, but, you know, two pilots for both aircraft. So I think when they talk with SWAPA, this could have a few more issues, but we'll see how it goes. Spirit. Boom.
That's a noise you never really want to hear unless it's a military aircraft.
On Friday, Spirit filed with the SEC saying they want to do a $300 million IPO. So that was kind of exciting.
But the only one that's made $9 at a time.
but it was interesting just to look at their financials. And I think the prospectus is – well, the filing is over like 100 pages. I haven't gone through every nitty-gritty detail. But I guess I just find it interesting for their total revenue for the first half of this year, 27% of it came from ancillary revenue. And I feel that percentage is only going to go up because...
What was that word?
Ancillary. Sorry.
And ancillary. We Americans say ancillary. Are you a Canadian? Are you a subject of the crown that you would say ancillary?
I prefer highway robbery.
Oh, I've been calling it ancillary for like 2 years and no one's corrected me. What the hell? Anyway, so that's I feel it's only going to go up because in August they introduced that carry-on bag fee. The strike kind of screwed up their financial results. They actually had a net loss for the first half of this year, but still an operating profit. But the company's estimating about their pilot strike hit their operating income by about $19 million. They about like $23 million lost revenue and some additional costs, but that was compensated with slightly by reduced costs. I mean, when you're not flying the planes, you're not paying for fuel and such. So that'll be interesting, but they seem to really believe in this low-cost carrier model, and, I mean, they seem to be making money with it. I mean, everyone likes making fun of Spirit, but, I mean, they're making people fly them.
Talking about not paying for fuel, I was looking through their SEC filing. Their fuel cost... They basically, in 2008, when oil spiked, their hedging saved them $70 million on a what would have been a $360 million fuel bill.
Hmm.
And so, you know, looking at their operating numbers from that, they were 2008, their EBITDA was $160 million. That's essentially money, $60 million worth of money in the owner's pockets, because they had an operating profit and it wouldn't have taken them negative, but it would have killed a chunk of their profit.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, we always talk about fuel hedging, but there it is, right? You know, just playing out for everyone to see.
Yeah. I think it actually hurt them a little bit in the first half of this year, but not a whole lot. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything else really shocking. Bag fees was the biggest source of the extra revenue. I'm not going to say ancillary anymore because I'll be mocked.
Well, you'll be mocked either way. So just pick your poison.
Yeah, I think that's about it. But I think Indigo, who invests in Spirit and a few other airlines, I think they'll probably do very well here. And actually, correction from like to correct a podcast error I made in like August, Indigo, this investment firm, is not the same as Indigo, the airline in India. But they Indigo is actually the same airline that, you know, is behind that airline in Russia with the bikini ad.
Right.
So.
Okay. Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, September 16th, 2010.
Well, g'day folks, Steve here, back for the Australia Desk for episode 115 of the Airplane Geek Show, and with me as always is Grant McHerron. G'day, mate.
Hey, mate, how you going?
I'm just amazed. You know, we thought last week that we were really organised recording on a Friday, but today it's actually Thursday and we're recording. What's going on?
That's right, we've brought it even further forward. So, you're probably right, you'll still wind up doing the editing at midnight on Sunday, but hey, at least we're recording early. Although, knowing our luck, Dan will wind up trumping us on some piece of Australia Pacific news that comes out between now and then.
Yeah, Dan likes doing that. He loves tormenting us.
Yeah, well, hey, we've got some big news down here. So which one are we going to talk about, mate? What are we going to discuss? We've got, okay, I'll give you a few of the big headlines, like Boeing lifting their forecast for aircraft usage in Oceania. No DC-10 water bomber this season. This fire season, we are instead getting a couple of Convair 580s. Woohoo!
Yeah.
And another Ericsson Skycrane. Whee! Cool. But no DC-10. Indications are that British Airways may be wanting to merge with Qantas. But once again, Qantas is saying, no, I'm not dancing with you.
Wouldn't be the first time they've tried that game at British Airways.
I know. And it's like, you know, they still haven't even finished merging in with Iberia, but they want, anyhow, British Airways, they're just British, whatever. OSA. Meanwhile, Borghetti is going to fight the Department of Transport and the ACCC, who, of course, as we've been reporting recently, have kicked them back on their trans-Tasman alliances. And they're asking for 3 weeks more to figure things out. But that's not stopping Qantas objecting to the Virgin Etihad Alliance. So this is kind of nasty on Qantas's part. I mean, they do this. It's okay if they do this because they're in with British Airways. They co-chair with South African across to Johannesburg. They're linked up with American in the US. But oh no, if Virgin wants to do this, no, that's too bad. I mean, just because Virgin's taken over their ex-girlfriend in the form of Etihad, but
yeah,
I
think that's an interesting point. You know, and we speculated a couple of weeks ago, Grant, you know, about how the mood of the boardroom would have been up there in Sydney at Qantas HQ when this news came down. And obviously they're not happy. I mean, there's no friends where business is concerned. So I guess they'll be doing everything they can now to frustrate that deal. It's in their interest to do it.
Definitely. So which one of these are we going to cover in depth? Because these are all big items, man. It's big news.
Yeah, well, that's all interesting big news. But, you know, there's other really big news, Grant.
What? Big?
I've heard there's some minor US TV talk show host coming out here.
Oh, not Jerry.
No. No, worse. Oprah Winfrey.
No, all is forgiven. Bring back Jerry. Oosh, oosh, punch. You know, that's good stuff.
Yes, Oprah Winfrey. Now, she's coming out here in December to do a show at the Sydney Opera House, which they're going to rename the Oprah House. How inventive, Grant, for the day.
Oh, ow.
And then she's coming down here to shop in trendy Melbourne, so says her PR people. Now, Melbourne Talk Radio host Steve Vizard was on the radio yesterday having a few interesting suggestions about how things might be if she wants the real Melbourne experience.
I think we should give them a genuine Melbourne arrival. None of this fancy stuff. I think they should arrive at Avalon. I think Seven should be filming border security there. There's another 3 hours of tiring her up. I reckon by the time she starts till the shop, till she drops, she'll be back at the airport trying to get out of the place.
She's not wrong about that, mate. I tell you what, bring her into Avalon. That's an experience for her.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's just like arriving in Brisbane back in the 80s where we flew in from Auckland and it was, you know, went down the air bridge. It was all professional and cool. We arrive in Brisbane and have to walk down air stairs and across the tarmac in the rain to a Jack the Slasher food barn kind of warehouse. That was where customs was. So at least Avalon has slightly nicer amenities than that, but it's still nowhere near as good as Tulla if you're arriving from overseas.
Yeah, take a trip up the Geelong Freeway, get snapped by a few speed cameras along the way. That's the real Melbourne experience.
Yeah, totally.
Now, the interesting part is where the aviation side of it fits in here, of course, is that she's coming out here with Qantas. She made the big announcement with John Travolta, who's a big ambassador for Qantas. Now, John Travolta is actually a qualified 747 pilot, I think, Grant, isn't he? He did his training out here at the Sydney Simulator Centre a few years ago, and he's been a major ambassador for Qantas ever since and does a great job for them. So I don't think he'll be flying. In fact, they're coming out here on an A380, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Well, John does fly his own 707, which is an ex-Qantas aircraft. So it's been painted up in Qantas colours. And so he's a Qantas ambassador. They did put him through the 747 pilot training as well as getting him his 707 endorsement. But I don't know if I'll take that back. You know he's going to wind up on the flight deck of the A380 for the photo PR.
And speaking of Virgin, Grant, we'll do our one serious story of the week. And this is talking about Sir Richard Branson's recent visit out here for Virgin Blue's 10th birthday. And he had some rather interesting comments to make regarding the state of the business out here.
Yeah, well, he came here at a really interesting time with the whole alliance strategy reeling as it gets kicked to the curb. But he's saying that Virgin Virgin will undercut Qantas. He's also saying they're upset, of naturally, about the Department of Transport and ACCC decisions, and that they may actually pull out of the Trans-Tasman market altogether. And that's pretty interesting that they would let that one go to Qantas, Jetstar, and Air New Zealand, plus, of course, Emirates and anyone else who steps in to fill the void.
Well, that's a really interesting prospect and very smart strategy on their part. On the one hand, the ACCC is saying, you know, if they have this tie-up that they want to have, that it's going to be anti-competitive and could possibly lead to fewer flights going across and therefore prices will go up. However, they're saying, well, fine, we'll pack up our bat and ball and go home. That's going to lead pretty much to the same thing, because if Qantas and Air New Zealand and Etihad to a lesser extent, if they have that route to themselves, it's going to be the same thing and prices will go up.
Yeah, it's very, very possible. However, if prices do go up and there's seem to be a market, don't forget AirAsia X are looking at jumping across the Tasman as well. So Etihad may keep their prices down just to get more and more traffic. Who knows?
Yeah, well, of course, Etihad's in a kind of, and we've talked about this before, where they're in a kind of a unique position. They're really making that trip across carrying freight. And that's yeah. they offer some very competitive deals. And we ought to get ourselves on one of those flights and go over there one day.
I think so. I mean, of course, we'd be self-loading freight then.
Yeah, that's right.
Self-loading freight, that would be us. But the last big bit of news from Branson was that he says the Virgin name is here to stay. That we've been talking a little bit about the negotiations with Singapore Airlines, who have the veto rights on any other international Virgin-named airlines. And, we've been wondering if it's going to be V Australia for the whole company or if it's going to be Virgin Australia or what's going to happen. Well, Branson has indicated that Virgin will stay in the name. They're not going to take that out.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's a good strategy. They're well-established, and they've been here 10 years now. It would be silly to, even if they change it to V Australia, which, you know, we'd sort of heard they were considering that some point, really. I mean, they've got the brand name established here now. It would be rather foolish to, you know, to change that. Of course, they could colour their planes blue instead of red. That would be rather less confusing.
Well, that was that whole True Blue thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, mate, we might leave it there for this week. Now, we do realise from the last show that Dan did give us a bit of homework. In answer to your question, point one, we don't talk funny. What's he talking about, Grant? We don't have an accent. We keep talking.
Truth, mate.
He's rather confused anyway. He's only a young fella, so.
Yeah, I know. He's kids.
Anyway, in answer to your other question about how Qantas and Jetstar are going to organise the scheduling where they're going to be competing on the same routes, we're not exactly sure. We can, we can certainly make up a good story, but we've actually been in contact today with Qantas's media unit, and we hope to be able to speak to somebody during the next week or so, and they'll be able to tell us exactly how they're going to make those decisions, and we'll record some of that and put it on the next Ausdesk.
Yeah, so sorry you got to wait another week, but we're going to get it straight from the horse's mouth. Just how does Qantas do their route planning and figure out how many Qantas flights versus Jetstar flights they should have on a given route? Stay tuned and watch this space, as they say.
Yeah, of course, naturally, the way things have been going in the Qantas group, I'd say they'd probably prioritise as many Jetstar flights as they can and throw a smattering of City Flyer Qantas services around it.
If there's market for that margin, they'll put a premium in there because they need the money.
Well, that's just about everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk, folks. Seeing as we're so organised, Grant, I could probably get this edited and, I don't know, maybe finish off that episode 43 of Playing Crazy Down Under we've been working on.
Oh, that'd be pretty cool. Max won't know himself if he gets this on Sunday morning his time.
Well, I can still leave it till Sunday night and get it out in the wee small hours of Monday morning, just to be consistent, Grant. We like consistency.
Yeah, we do have a reputation. We do have a reputation to live down to.
That's right. I am a train driver, so, of course, nothing ever runs on time in this house.
Oh.
There we go. And whilst train passengers around the world are contemplating the truth of that statement, we'll talk to you next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
A couple of very quick things.
Okay.
First, Stephen Grant, thank you for looking into that. Two, first, with I think where they meant Emirates with the cargo rates across the Tasman, I think, because I don't think Etihad is in New Zealand. Gavin, John, any?
It might be. It depends, because they fly a 300ER, I think, from Brisbane to Christchurch. I remember seeing a 300ER land in Christchurch. An Emirates. And the 380 goes to Auckland.
I meant they were saying Etihad, and I think it's Emirates. I think they meant Emirates.
I don't know. Etihad flies a 340-500. I'm amazed if they actually fit all the passengers' bags in that thing and have enough fuel to get over there.
Yeah. Okay. Just wondering. And M plus Emirates is aligned with Virgin in that thing. What was the other thing I was going to say? With stuff like, you know, Emirates being the ex-girlfriend of Qantas moving over Virgin, and then DOT smacking down Delta V. And actually, DOT this past week did say to Delta and Virgin that they will extend the deadline for them to respond to the DOT preliminary ruling by 3 weeks. This epitomizes the phrase that's tossed around right now, that of airline soap opera. And I think eventually it'll get down to the point of who poisoned the guacamole, which I believe was a question asked in Passions season 7. So, yeah.
All right.
Interestingly enough, guacamole allowed through security. Hummus, not so much.
Why?
Apparently it has something to do with hummus being spreadable, like stupidity.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank Steve and Grant. Of course, you can find their podcast at plaincrazydownunder.com. You know, they've also archived all of their Australia Desk reports on a single web page. So if you're interested in kind of going back or following through those sequentially, you can do that on that page. We'll put that in the show notes. All right. Let's wrap this thing up, guys. We'd like to thank our guest this episode. That was Chris Mano. He's an airline captain. Find his blog at www.jethead.wordpress.com. It's actually a terrific blog worth checking out. Also, you can find his humor, his aviation humor cartoons, at www.flightcrewzoo.com. We also want to thank John Ostrower for joining us for a bit of the program. John, it's always great to have you on.
My pleasure.
And, of course, you can find John at Flight Blogger. Why don't you give us the address?
It's flightglobal.com/flightblogger.
And on Twitter, also Flight Blogger, right?
Flight Blogger everywhere.
Very good. And also, thanks, Gavin, for joining us. That's Gavin Werbeloff. Gavin, where can people find you online? Have you got a spot?
You can find me on Twitter at travel_Buddha, BUDDHA.
Outstanding. All right, Rob, why don't you tell folks where they can find you online?
They'll find me at jetwine.com, where Scott and I hang out and talk about things aviation-wise as well. And kudos to the Cessna people for not having to endure a strike this week. That's going to be welcome news down in Wichita, absolutely, where I just came back from. But listen, special shout-out this week to one of our listeners, Jamie Dodson, has been posting comments on our Facebook page occasionally. He just sent me a note here as we're recording and says that he and I went to the same high school together just a couple of years apart.
No kidding.
So
small world.
Yeah, small world. And next week I'll have to do our high school fight song and whatever the hell that was. But so jetwine.com, and on Twitter I'm at jetwine also. And as always, thank you all for listening.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dan Webb, where can people find you?
You can find me on my blog, thingsofthesky.com, Twitter, Dan Webbage. And also, in a couple weeks, you can find me at my off-Broadway show, Tears of Jet A, of the story of a young intern seeking the approval of his grandfather figure, who is the editor of jetwine.com.
Did you think of that in advance and write it out, or did that just come to you now?
That kind of just happened.
Oh, okay, good, good.
That's impressive.
I've got to tell you, the kid amazes me.
Yeah,
and wow, that warms my heart.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. Next week, David Vanderhoof will return. He's going to have some interviews from the air show that he visited this weekend. I also was at a fly-in and got the chance to see the Terra Fugia and have a short interview with Carl Dietrich, who's the one of the founders and CEO of Terra Fugia. So we'll look for that next week.
That sounds like one of those energy drinks.
Terra Fugia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Okay.
Be sure to find us on airplanegeeks.com. You can read comments from listeners and leave your own. You can follow us on Twitter at Airplane Geeks.
And the question of the week, as always, will be John Ostrower and Flight Global. Would you actually hire that kid back?
I think he's technically working for us right now.
Oh, wow.
This is true. This is true.
As always, we'd love to get your voicemail. You can call our listener line. Benet Wilson will tell us about that.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
All right, I think that's it for episode 115. Be sure to join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Bye, everybody. Good night, Harriet.
Good night.
Be well, Harriet.
Good night, Harriet.
Night, Harriet.
Also here to help us with the news is... What was that? You have a really important question, Dan?
Yes.
I actually have to follow Dan, so...
I know.
Why is this SpongeBob mac and cheese so delicious?
I knew that was going to be your... I knew it. It was going to be something that was just completely non sequitur.
Yeah.
Dan, come back.
You know, Max, I have a question that kind of follows up on Dan's earlier comment about the SpongeBob mac and cheese.
Yeah, Rob.
Oh my God.
I'm kind of curious to know why a fellow is bright. You know, John's always struck me as a very bright guy.
He is. The first time I met him, I'm
just kind of trying to figure out why. He doesn't understand the difference between 19 and 26. You know, like he was supposed to be on the show the 26th.
Oh, I thought you were talking about my age and Dan's age.
Yeah, I take it too.
No, I want to debate about, I don't know, something.
No, next time.
Dan, get some feeling mac left and out. Cheese.
Here's a quick question. Okay, everyone. Rob, what is your Middle East peace plan?
To send Dan there.
That's one of those random thoughts, right? Max, can we cut this guy off?
Yeah.
Actually, is John still here?
Bye.
John's still here.
Bye, Dan.
Oh, okay. Bye, Dan. I saw you. Hey, Rob. Screw you.
Whoa! Someone's getting stroppy.
A little testy here.
God, you know he gets cranky when he doesn't get enough food.
That's right.
Desert juice box.
No, I actually just finished my peanut butter crackers. Actually, so.
All right, let's wrap this thing up, guys.
Yeah, quick, Max, please.
We've devolved a bit.
We have than a bit. Or send us email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com.
Whoa.
Whoops.